The next time you pay bills, take a look closely at some of those bills. Notice the basic charges, but take a look at those add-ons. What kinds of fees are you being charged in addition to the service itself provided? Across the entire economy, the impact of fees can get huge, and it makes a difference in things like upward mobility. That's the case Devin Fergus makes in his book, Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class. Devin Fergus is a professor of history, black studies, and public affairs at the University of Missouri. He also contributes policy expertise to the Aspen Institute and the Center for Global Policy Solutions, Washington-based think tanks. Land of the Fee is also a documentary film based upon the book. Devin, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Jeffrey, thanks so much for having me today, though I wish it was on a more upbeat topic.
Yeah, not a very upbeat topic. And it's interesting, too, to notice the inverse proportion between the length of the word fee and all it refers to. It's a really huge realm, isn't it?
No, that's a fascinating, interesting point, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, everything gets sort of packed into the idea and concept of fee. Particularly when the private sector wants to try to avoid regulatory oversight, they may call something a fee, for instance, frankly, because it doesn't trigger the kind of regulatory oversight, let's say, interest rate does, frankly. So you're absolutely right about the ways of the tentacles that the word fees actually connotes and suggests.
But that's interesting right there, because as you point out, if you call it a an interest rate, then you can still have something that is key then to the amount of money owed or the amount of money on the transaction. But if it's called a fee, it doesn't invite regulatory scrutiny.
Yeah. So we there's a long history of usury laws and usury caps in the U.S. And they sort of ebb and flow in terms of the ways in which they're in which they're employed in society. So, for instance, in the late 19th century, there's a pushback by the populace, let's say, to roll back things like interest rates and usury. And again, usury has a long sort of history, well beyond the U.S., going back to sort of biblical times. And this notion of usury is a way of a high or exploitive sort of interest rate. And so usury has sort of been codified in laws in ways that fees have been able to sort of escape both law and regulatory oversight, at least until sort of recently. And so the idea of interest rate or suggest usury or overcharging a consumer for a product, and then that triggers, again, greater financial policing of a product. And we've seen this throughout the late 19th century of concerns about usury perhaps make us sort of revisit it and then come back a little bit in the 20th century. Again, the concerns about fees is really a relatively new sort of concern in American society.
I can see, and it happens to me when I look at bills, it's like, oh, look at that, a $2.50 service charge for the insurance company, or, $10 for handling here, that sort of thing. I mean, obviously they get bigger based on the size of the transaction, too. How important are these to the profits in the financial industry?
They're tremendously important to the profits in financial industry. And let me take a step back and say, again, you're in California.
California and Oregon, stuff, basically, yeah.
California and Oregon, precisely. So in the public sector, there's been a lot of conversation in recent years about the rise of public sort of fees. So since 1970 to 2014, 75-80% of all new government revenue is generated not from taxes but through other means like fines and fees. And so that's been a big subject in recent sort of years. The rise of fees in the public sector has really sort of been mirrored in the rise of fees in the private sector. And so in 2016, the National Economic Council put out a report indicating that the growing trend and magnitude of fees in the U.S. economy and the ways in which these fees sort of systematically transfer wealth from individuals to corporations, from individuals to institutions. There's been little conversation about not simply the rise of fees in the private sector, but the rise of fees in private sector where in areas that are key to upward mobility. So, for instance, the Economic Council's report, when it talks about fees, it talks about fees like a hotel resort fees or maybe a concert fee or fee for cell phone fees. And these fees are Again, they're problematic. They're a nuisance. And even so, even more so than that, the economic council indicates that, again, they also transfer wealth. But what this report doesn't highlight or indicate is the ways in which these fees have risen up in areas which are critical of upward mobility in the U.S. And so I think one of the key things people might get from my book is the escalating cost of these fees. When I say escalating cost, I mean these fees escalated beyond the cost of inflation in areas like housing or education or employment. What connects us to home and school and work, if you live anywhere west of the Hudson River, and that's like the automobile, and so people have to drive to school, have to drive home, have to drive to work. And in those four spheres, you see an incredible escalating cost of fees in those areas. And that's really what I try to highlight in my work.
All right. So housing, higher ed, employment, and transportation come up big here. Give us a bit of a history lesson here, if you would, Devin Fergus. You say we once had the broker state. What was that?
Sure. And so throughout much of the 20th century, particularly coming out of things like the sort of New Deal era, it was a working, really, even trace longer than that, really come out of the progressive period in many ways. There was this working notion that the state or government was there to broker on behalf of consumers, particularly hardworking middle class and the working poor in many instances, on behalf of the power elite. The broker on behalf of consumers and the working poor, in relationships with the power elite. They understood that the power advantage and the economic and political policy advantage that the power elite actually had in U.S. And so the broker state existed to broker on behalf of, again, the middle class and working Americans. And so that began to really erode in the 1970s somewhat, and then sort of certainly the 1980s and subsequent since then. And so the broker state is in effect sort of broken. And so now we have interests, particularly special sort of interests, who have tipped the scales of balance on behalf of private, corporate, and increasingly really financial sub-interests. Other scholars have pointed it out, like Greta Krippner and others have talked about the rise of this, these sort of special interests on behalf of really shipping policy. And I really should try to highlight those things in my book as well.
Okay, we'll get to those in just a few minutes. The book is called Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class. It's the work of Devin Fergus at the University of Missouri. You notice I'm not asking you to join us by phone or email. We're a little shorthanded here today, so it's just me on the button. So we can't take phone calls and emails, but enjoy the rest of our conversation as we continue with Devin Fergus here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about fees in this hour of the exchange, those little charges that show up on the bottom of credit card statements and cell phone bills and utility bills and all that sort of stuff. And they loom a lot larger when you start talking about larger transactions like student loans, home loans, that sort of thing. Fees really add up over time, as Devin Fergus, a historian at the University of Missouri, points out in his book, Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class. We are talking about what happens with those fees and the fact that they actually provide some downward pressure on upward mobility in the United States. I can't invite you to join us on the exchange today because we're shorthanded, so I can't take phone calls and emails from you, but thank you for listening. And Devin, I want to come back to the history lesson just a little bit because you talked about the broker state we once had where the government tried to make sure that people didn't get too hurt by business practices. Some keys emerge in the late 60s and 70s in changing that. You get into the Truth in Lending Act, or TILA. That was a catalyst. What did that do?
Sure. So Truth in Lending Act really basically required or encouraged financial lenders to be more transparent in how they calculate things like interest rates or APRs. And so you're right. So what we find in the 60s and 70s is a genuine, really a sincere effort, I think, by the federal government to try to expand credit and make credit more accessible and democratic. In fact, scholars talk about the democratization of credit in the 1970s. And TILA is one of those examples, going back into the 60s under the Johnson administration to really sort of expand credit and to make it more democratic by making it more transparent in many ways. And then we find similar things in the 1970s, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act in the mid-70s, the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, and things like even the Community Reinvestment Act. So these efforts were largely designed to, like with TILA, to protect consumers more so and to make it, consumer transactions more transparent so consumers know exactly what they're actually paying, itemizing things, as well as to expand and democratize the credit to historically communities that have been outside of really the mainstream, or the mainstream sort of consumer practices and consumer business practices and engagement in populations which are only sort of recently coming into really the workforce, particularly, let's say, women. The ECOA, Equal Credit Opportunity Act, was largely designed to help and facilitate women as they moved into the workforce, become more consumers. Yet, as I point out in my work, shortly thereafter, as we try to democratize, as government has a sincere effort to open, expand credit, to democratize it, shortly thereafter, there's an effort to really remove oversight from credit transactions, and this sort of happens at the early sort of 1980s. And so I think part of the argument is this is not a one-size-fit-all system or one way or the other. So you want transparency in credit transactions, but too often the industry falls back on an argument of defense of transparency and making financial contracts almost illegible. So again, not certainly not on this station, but you listen to some other radio stations, and at the end of an ad, let's say for a vehicle or something, they go on this very long sort of explanation about the credit terms that are provided. So long, in fact, that it's unintelligible.
Yeah, I've noticed that they speak even faster than a human being possibly can speak and get all the stuff in there about your approved credit, you know. 3 months down, this much required at signing, that sort of thing.
100% right, Jeffrey. But yeah, I mean, from the industry's perspective, that's transparency. And so there's a tipping point, right, that yes, you want transparency, but not so much so in which the consumer is sort of overwhelmed by either the length of a document or intelligible sort of explanation. And so others have pointed out that financial contracts are basically 8 times longer now than they were than our parents or grandparents sort of period. And so financial documents have gotten longer, I'll say. They've gotten more complicated under the guise of transparency. Yet at the same time, our lives have gotten, at least at the times we have to digest and understand and interpret this financial information, has gotten shorter. And so I think... And so I think this is one of the good things I think a historian can bring to this conversation, this broader context, this broader perspective than, let's say, an economist or something, people who look at, often look a bit more sort of narrowly at things. And so financial lives have gotten more complex, at least financial documents have gotten more complex, and our lives to interpret these documents have gotten shorter. So, for instance, Jeffrey, that I think the length of commute for the average American now is 28 minutes, so 7-8 minutes longer than it was a generation ago. So can we have commuting longer distances? We're working longer hours, Jeffrey. I'm constantly tethered to my device. I was up emailing 5 o'clock this morning, late last night. So our lives are larded with work and employment as we're tethered to devices. We're commuting longer distances. And then if you're a parent, you're in this sort of extracurricular sort of war with the household next door as you take a little Johnny to soccer practice or to violin, or take him to a language school to be competitive, so your child can have a competitive advantage to get into a post-secondary school. And so lives of U.S. households have gotten far more complicated. You have less time to interpret documents, a precise moment of time when documents have gotten more complex. And so how do you square that circle? And I think one way in which you square that circle is by bringing in, returning to this idea of a broker state, as you mentioned earlier, and bringing in financial regulators who are expert at cutting through some of the legalese and the language used to cloak some predatory terms, to be quite frank.
Devin Fergus is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a professor of history, black studies, and public affairs at the University of Missouri. His book is Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class. I can't invite you to join us today. We can't take phone calls and emails today, but thanks for listening. So let's move into the four key realms that you look at in the book: housing, higher education, employment, and transportation. You've touched on all these at least a little bit. With housing, it seems like the fees are really important to the profitability of subprime loans. And so what happens is it seems like you have people who might be eligible for somewhat better financial products getting steered towards subprime loans.
Well, you're 100% right. And so initially, subprime is supposed to define the profile of the actual borrower, that the borrower has a lower credit score, usually somewhere below six, mid 600s. Well, that's been increased recently, but historically, traditionally below the mid 600s. And so subprime is said that the borrower's credit score is below prime, which is, again, usually in the upper sixes, early low sevens. Subprime loans became so sort of profitable by the mid 2000s, late 2000s, that they were actually being marketed to people who are prime eligible because of the profitability of these actual loans and the terms of these loans. So now the crisis that sort of happens in 2007, 2008, 2009, in many ways was predictable because we saw a similar thing where it happened in the early 1980s in California, where a couple they take out what we consider a subprime sort of mortgage. It has and the subprime mortgage has a balloon payment at the end of it. They see this balloon payment at the end of it, and they're persuaded basically by their lender and the realtor that they can refinance this balloon payment, but unable to really refinance that balloon payment at the end of it. And so this couple basically end up having their house foreclosed. And this is just one example. There's example after example in California where the subprime mortgage market actually, in many ways, sort of starts sort of first in the early 1980s. And despite all these warning signs, these canaries in the sort of coal mine, lawmakers still move forward with codifying subprime as a national sort of mortgage instrument.
So we had watched it blow up on us once, and still went ahead and let it continue to grow.
No, precisely. And there you get the story where you, again, the value of the broker state and the need for regulatory mechanisms and control, because what happened was that the lawmakers who are supposed to provide sort of regulatory oversight are receiving financial kickbacks from the mortgage lending industry. And so
you call them kickbacks, you mean campaign contributions, don't you?
Pardon?
Yeah, you call them kickbacks, but officially they're campaign contributions, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. The campaign, absolutely right. Their campaign contributions, and they're used to put in the coffers of these people for office. And again, this is directly, I'm so glad you brought it up. This is directly tied to notions of financial lobbying, the campaign contributions, because what the research shows is that the candidate who receives more financial contributions than its opponent is likely to win 90% of the time, 9 out of 10 elections. So contributions translate into electoral victory. It also crowds out competition, too. You see someone with large sort of financial coffers, with a large sort of financial war chest, you're less likely to find someone willing to compete for that particular race. And so the ways in which the private sector mortgage lending industry in the story of subprime is able to flood the market and to underwrite those who are writing the laws for subprime is one of the really major untold stories about the origin of the crisis.
So here again, we move into the next issue that you bring up, education, and this interlocks with housing. I mean, how much less likely is someone to buy a home if they're still paying off student loans?
Again, that's an excellent point. While the book starts with home ownership and housing first, I could have very well started with higher education, because education is the first major encounter that consumers have with consumer finance, really. It's taking out a student loan at 18. And here you kind of understand the ways in which the federal government got involved in the student lending industry. They had to underwrite it and subsidize it and guarantee it so much to lenders. I mean, the system could be very well different, but you understand it. I mean, just think about this logic, Jeffrey. You're a 17-year-old person with no assets, no job, no credit history. You're going to go to a bank and lender and ask that bank and lender for, at least today, you say $30,000. The promise that you're going to pay it back in 4 years, even though you have no credit history and no assets, no employment. And if you don't go to graduate school, right? It could be 6 or 7 years. And so that logic in and of itself meant that if you're going to have the private sector involved in this system, you're going to have to subsidize and provide a guaranteed student loan. So having the private sector involved in this system in the first place is probably one of the great flaws. It's probably one of the great flaws of really having student lending involved in education, really. And so what happens is we have this inflated sort of cost for education now, and the cost for college education, as I mentioned earlier, I think it's about $30,000. Is the average graduating senior comes out owing about $30,000, and nearly 3 out of 4 college students assume a student loan. And again, the people who are assuming student loans are historically vulnerable populations, i.e. women or communities of color. And so you have a $30,000 student loan, and that increases your debt-to-income ratio. And we all know that a stronger debt-to-income ratio correlates with a lower credit score. And if you have a lower credit score, it means that you will often have a higher mortgage payment. And so you have to pay more points for your mortgage. And so here you have a student loan, which on the face of that document of most student loans, it says the student loan needs to be paid back in 10 years. The average borrower takes twice as long, 20 years, to pay back a student loan. And in that period of time, you're trying to buy a mortgage, and your mortgage is higher because of the higher debt-to-income ratio usually. And so it really does extract all of this wealth from households, which are in many ways struggling in the first place. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't have taken out a student loan. And so, I mean, the student loan has a cascading effect that lasts far beyond the 10 years it says on that typical contract of a student loan. 20 years and often longer than that, and having an intergenerational effect on the wealth that a family or a household or a parent is able to pass down to their children. So again, having a great intergenerational sort of wealth effect of extracting resources and assets from households and families.
Now, Devin, the principal at a student loan is going to get high. It's been getting higher because of the cost of education getting higher over the years. But how much of what students end up paying back, or former students end up paying back, is fees?
Sure, that's an excellent question. Often it could be at least as much, it could be 3 or 4 times even more. And those fees come out, things like origination fees. And origination fee is something that comes about, again, in this period of the 1980s I referenced before, or an activation fee, where one of the arguments they you can wrap your mind around this is that the nation is trying to balance its budget in the 1980s. And one of the ways they're going to balance the budget is by charging origination fees, activation fees on these sort of student loans. So that's one example of a fee. There's been numerous stories, too, about students being channeled into things like the deferment or the payments, which adds additional fees onto the student loan or default payment on a student loan. And so all these fees from the activation fee to deferment fee, which you often charge, some student loans also have balloons for the payments. That too is, again, could be considered a fee. And there's also, I mean, so these are fees as a form of expenses, but we can also look at consumer expenses. We also look at fees really in terms of on the front end with higher college education, and really the lack of resources that the states now give to universities. And what I mean by that is tuition and fees. Right. So again, California is a wonderful example. Again, California used to have one of the best sort of post secondary education sort of system in the country. It kept tuition was at one point I think sort of free there and kept relatively low. The ways in which universities in places like California and Oregon and in Missouri were able to keep tuition kind of under wraps was by increasing things like fees. So now I teach a class every Tuesday, Thursday at 9:30 in the morning. And if you pay your tuition but you didn't pay your fee, you cannot sit in my class. So these fees, which people suggest or imply might be optional, I think in Oregon, for instance, they're having some fees related to things like vehicle registration and voluntary fees there in terms of driving. But many of these fees, again, like in terms of access to college education, are not optional. They are required. Mm-hmm. So if you pay your tuition but not your registration fee, then you cannot officially sit in my classroom. And so, again, they've been able to say we've kept tuition relatively low, but that doesn't account for the cost of fees.
Right, and you teach at a place where I was a student, and I remember checking in the early 90s, about 10 years after I'd graduated, and by that time, the cost of a year's education at the University of Missouri had already tripled, and it's gone up since that time as well. Devin Fergus is our guest on The Exchange. His book is Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class. We'll come back to the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the proliferation of fees in the American economy and all the different charges that we pay that are not necessarily the main point of what we're paying for in the first place, but they get tacked on and increase the amount that we have to pay, and in some cases provide downward pressure, that upward mobility can be slowed, is the case that Devin Fergus makes in his book Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class. We'd invite you to join this conversation on The Exchange. However, we do not have anybody to answer the phones or tend to the emails today, so sit back and listen and enjoy the conversation, and thank you for doing so. I want to come back to one point about student loans in particular, because you've got the argument the likes of William Bennett makes that you're going to make a lot more over your lifetime because you went to college. But then there's the other argument that I think you're making here, that you're going to end up so in debt you can end up permanently behind because you went to college.
No, you're absolutely right. And by no means am I making a case that one should not opt for college. Absolutely. College is valuable in so many different ways, certainly in terms of upward mobility and employment, but also in terms of people you have access to and get to interact with from across the world now. So certainly a college education has that great value. Just what greater honesty. I was in a room with a university president from another university, not mine, and this person was making a case about the great value of college education, including student loans. But what the university president did not say is that the ways in which a student loan, again, as I mentioned before, drags down one's sort of credit score, makes it prolongs home ownership. And this is critical and key because home ownership is a primary way in which wealth is built in our free market private property economy. And so if families and graduates are postponing home ownership, they're also postponing asset building. And again, that has all kinds of implications sort of down the road. And so just a bit to fill in the picture a bit more than what others have sort of argued. And the university our president that I referenced was someone from the oppositional party, from Bill Bennett. And so it's just trying to kind of correct this sort of picture that people from both parties actually might have about the ways in which student loan has an impact and doesn't have an impact, actually.
So let's move into the area of employment. Again, the four key realms that you look at for fees here are housing, higher education, employment, and transportation. So here we go into employment, and we talk about payday loans. Did they arise about the time that that wages began to stagnate in the United States?
No, you're absolutely correct. And so I describe sort of payday loans in my work as really the free market's response to the problem of crisis of wage stagnation. And so wages, as you mentioned, wages really begin to stagnate in the early sort of 1970s. So the average non-supervisory worker today, adjusted for inflation, at least up through the Great Recession, adjusted for inflation, actually earns less than they did in the early 1970s. And so how does a household, this average non-supervisory worker, how do they try to close this gap between income and expenses? Well, we know it now. What happens during these intervening sort of decades is increasingly women join the workforce. That's one way in which they try to close these gaps. When that gap is completely closed, women join into the workforce, we work extra longer hours, right? Wage workers do, trying to build in some overtime. And when those two things don't work, then what we see actually what the historical record sort of shows is that individuals and households started tapping into their home equity. Those who are homeowners began to use their homes in part as these sort of, drawn down for the savings from their houses. And when those three legs of the stool didn't work, they often and frequently sort of turn to payday lenders. Payday lenders, again, a free market's really response to the crisis of wage stagnation. And I say that in part for the reason, because a payday loan is exactly how it sounds. A payday loan is a loan that's a short-term loan that's due back to the lender on your payday. So in order to take out a payday loan, at least conventionally, traditionally, you've had to have sort of two basic things. A paycheck, you have to show a paycheck stub. And then you also have to show, write them a check 2 weeks from the day you take out that loan from your actual bank. So much of the 20th century, in the post-World War II and the post-60s sort of era, we considered those two items, a paycheck and a bank account, of the markers of the middle class. And those are the things in which the payday loan stores online and bricks and mortar have relied upon to draw money from consumers. And so right now, there's also this, I'll say this too, Jeffrey, there's also this working notion that payday loans are something which are really marketed or targeted or used primarily by the working poor. And if that's the case, then there are a lot more working poor Americans than we imagine, because there are more payday loan stores, whether online and bricks and mortar, than there are Starbucks or McDonald's. And there's nothing which used to be yes.
Yeah, that was the one that really made my eyes go boing. You know, they find out that there are more payday loan places than Starbucks and McDonald's.
Yes, precisely. And then we think of Starbucks as this mark of middle class consumption, or McDonald's certainly as well. But no, there are more payday loan stores than those two monuments to the middle class. And so this is not something which is sort of that only the working poor sort of rely upon. This is something that increasingly middle class Americans need and rely upon as well. And so the private sector, again, is trying to meet really a need, not a perceived need, but very real need of the American economy, closing that gap between income and expenses. The problem arises with how they close that gap. And there you really do get to see which fees outstrip principal. And so the average payday loan borrower, when they finish with their loan, and many of these borrowers, they usually have to, the majority of borrowers wound up flipping their loan because they're unable to pay in 2 weeks later. So they wound up taking out another payday loan, which and that payday loan has more fees on top of it. So the average payday loan borrower ends up paying more in fees than they actually did in the original principal. And so it's a classic case of, again, the fees outstripping the principal. And I'll sort of say this, too, that it suggests and sort of illustrates that the power and influence of lenders in general, payday lenders among them, that the payday lenders, again, for many sort of years, sort of targeted military service basis, and that's in large part because they knew it was a younger population, which had very little experience with consumer issues and credit issues, and they also knew they had reliable paychecks, and so if you live in a military base, you're far more likely to live in the proximity of a payday lender. Now, the government tries to step in a period of time to protect these military personnel, but here you find lawmakers intervening, protecting the payday lending industry ahead of actually the military personnel, despite concerns by groups like National Military Family Association, and even in the Department of Defense, sometimes concerned about the targeting of military personnel. So, if military personnel, people who serve our country so valiantly and bravely, aren't protected and immune, then what that might say for the rest of us as consumers.
I have noticed how strong the backlash tends to be when state legislatures begin to talk about limiting payday loans. That's been fairly strong. Let's continue on the talk of regulation, though, because you point out that for all of Ronald Reagan's talk about limiting federal power, he increased the power that the feds have over states in consumer lending. How?
Yes. So would Reagan sort of supported and did is he supported the what's called the federal preemption of state usury caps. So I mentioned earlier before that almost all states have usury laws and usury caps. And so again, the Reagan administration, they wanted to give the federal government power to at least provide private sector, I should say, power to charge higher interest rates. But in order to do that, they would have to preempt state usury caps, state usury laws. And so here's the Reagan administration, who again it touts himself as a small government, and absolutely generally is across various sectors and segments of society. But except in this one area of consumer finance, we really see that this person who advocates states' rights really defers to federal preemption as supremacy. And so he allows for the intervention of state usury caps by the federal government, that allows them to list usury caps so that lenders across the country can charge higher interest rates for mortgage borrowers. And so it is certainly the outlier of Reagan as a state's writer, but it also says that when there are competing first principles, that the first principle of finance in terms of government takes precedent. So it's in many ways, it's as the saying goes, or like phrase, like primus inter pares of in terms of when these first principles clash. The financial sector takes priority.
Okay, financial sector comes first. So we have about 4 minutes left here. I want to ask about attempts in recent times to reinstitute some regulation, because we've watched the trials and tribulations of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which was largely a response to the subprime crisis and the crash of 2007-08, and yet there have been efforts to gut it pretty much ever since it began.
You know, you're absolutely right. And so the CFPB, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which comes out of the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010, is really the major instantiation of that Dodd-Frank Act. It was designed to, really for the first time, have a federal agency whose primary objective is to financially protect consumers. So, again, there are regulatory agencies out there which deal in lending and finance. But most of them are, in many ways, sort of conflicted. And so, for instance, the Federal Reserve, their first priority is system safety and soundness of financial institutions. It's not the individual consumer. It's not the consumer, right? And so yes, there are financial regulators out there, but the CFPB's primary aim and objective, its main aim and objective, is really to protect financial consumers. And so it gets created, as I said, the Dodd-Frank Act. Since its creation and implementation, there's been efforts to sort of roll it back ever since. And the erosion of CFPB, we saw recently that the ombudsman for the student CFPB, who was in charge of student lending and student loans, recently resigned because he felt that some of the evidence that he wanted to present and share was being muzzled. He wasn't allowed to sort of share it. And so, again, the CFPB has been eroding almost ever since it's been implemented. But I will take a step back and say, make this point about the CFPB. Despite all of the ways it's been eroded, and this is a historian me sort of speaking, the fact that the regulatory architecture is now there in place holds some promise that you can go back in, you can go and rebuild it up and establish it more sort of firmly. And so I'm at least very happy that the CFPB was passed, it was implemented, and the architecture is now there, perhaps for future administrations, which takes consumer financial issues more seriously, to basically be fully supported.
Deb, we've got about 30 seconds left. I will say that looking at all the things that have happened to regulation through the course of our recent history, it seems like as long as money rules politics, industries that make big money from fees will take that fee income, turn it into political contributions, and make sure the regulatory touch stays light.
Jeffrey, I couldn't have put it better myself. You're absolutely right. I mean, often when I do interviews, people ask me for policy suggestions, and I can provide you several litany, but there's really a meta policy that's involved that needs to be seriously considered to help restore economic democracy in the U.S. And it really starts with something like an anti-corruption and public integrity sort of bill or act, mm-hmm. which may be able to put a lifetime ban on lobbying elected officials. You're absolutely right. Every chapter I look at, every sphere I explore, there's these private interests which really shape and inform and deform within the public interest, actually.
Right. The book is called Land of the Fee, Hidden Costs and the Decline of the American Middle Class by Devin Fergus at the University of Missouri. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Jeffrey, for having me.